Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, and today it is my absolute pleasure to have as my guest, Scott Stewart. Growing up in a home that was less than supportive and filled with manipulation, combined with a poor role model as to what a father should be, Scott was not set up for success nor life. At the age of 22, he endured a life-altering event that would change the entire course of his existence. Investing the next 12 to 13 years into himself through counseling and self-development, working intentionally to overcome those rough years paid off. The result of that was a broken generational cycle of abuse. Today, he has a healthy, supportive, loving family who follows Christ. Amen. By day, Scott works in the healthcare field, assisting families with their aging loved one via either assisted living or memory care placement. Because of his life experience and real-world ability to overcome obstacles, he speaks professionally outside of his day job on overcoming adversity and why forgiveness is such a key component to moving your life forward and not being held back by your past circumstances. His belief is this: anything is forgivable if you hold the right belief about what forgiveness is and who it's for. Scott, welcome to the show, my friend. It's a privilege to have you here today, and I've been looking forward to our conversation for a long time.
Yeah, so have I, Dave. Thank you so much for having me on your show. It's an honor to be here, and I'm looking forward to our discussion.
And I think we got to give a shout out to Chris Mamone, the individual who introduced us. You were on his podcast, The Grief Empowerment Theory, right? And he connected with me and said, you got to meet Scott. We had a conversation, and one thing led to another, and I really felt your story would be a benefit to our audience, particularly when you're talking about forgiveness, because forgiveness is an easy word to pronounce, but it's a hard state to achieve.
Yeah, so, I love that. I may steal that exact sentence from you, Dave. As powerful as that is, it's easy to say, but it's a whole other thing to put into practice, right?
Absolutely. And yeah, feel free to steal it. You wouldn't be stealing it. I just gave you my permission to use it. So
I love it. Thank you. Thank you.
My pleasure. So, Scott, for those in my audience who don't know you, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Yeah, you betcha. Oh, my goodness. So I'm a father to two beautiful, amazing daughters, and I'm a husband to my wife of, we're now 26 years. I was fortunate enough to marry the neighbor girl. That's a true story. She lived right next door, and we were 4 years apart. And so when we started dating, pretty cool that she grew up and she was like, wow, dang. Look at that. So I married the neighbor girl next door. Going back even further than that, you know, I grew up in somewhat of rural America. We were probably 3-4 miles outside of a small town. And when I say small town, I'm talking 5,500, 6,000 people here in the Pacific Northwest. And I was adopted. So I never, until later in life, I never knew biologically who my parents were, but I was raised by a man who had some really serious anger issues. And he could go from zero to really intensely mad in seconds. What maybe made that even a little bit worse is that my mom, whom I was relatively close to most all my life, she was an enabler. And she always had an excuse for why he was mad. Why was he yelling? Why was he angry? She always had an excuse. And, loved my mom dearly. And again, as I said, we were certainly closer than my dad and I. But she was a world-class enabler. She knew how to do that. And, you know, when you're young, Dave, you only know what you grow up around. And I, at the time, I didn't know it was enabling. You know, I didn't know at the time that my dad had anger issues. I just thought that's the way dads were. And so that kind of set the stage, you know, for my family life all the way up until I was 18. And I grew up in, I love my parents. So we said our love yous. We said I love you back and forth. And we had, there were certainly some pleasant times in life and different things. But I grew up in fear. I grew up in fear of my father. Fear that if I did something just not right or did something wrong or didn't put the half-inch end wrench in the right drawer of the toolbox, you know, I was going to hear about it. And, you know, obviously looking back, not a healthy way to grow up. I, as a youngster, we know it now as ADD or ADHD. In those days, we didn't really know what that was. And my dad's answer to get me to pay attention and stay focused was just yell and take things away and discipline me, punish me, ground me. And then yell some more. I mean, that was his method. And of course, you know, we know today that doesn't work. That's not the answer. But I couldn't wait to get out of school, Dave, because I couldn't stay focused. I would read in an assignment. I would read a book, and then my mind would drift away, and I could never retain information. And as a result of that, all the way through grade school, middle school, high school, I failed. And when I say fail, I'm not talking about just got a low score. I mean, I failed 95-ish% of all the tests I ever took in school. Failed them. And when I say fail, I mean 50%, 40%. And it was because I couldn't retain information. I couldn't stay focused. Well, guess what my dad's, his answer to that was, right? So that kind of sets the stage of what life was like and the home life that I grew up in. And, you know, at the age of 18, when I finally graduated, just barely, I couldn't wait to get out of school and I couldn't wait to get away from my father because of the things that I just mentioned. So.
Yeah, that sounds to me just like a very unhealthy, a very unpredictable home environment you grew up in. And one of the things that had occurred to me as I was hearing your story was walking on eggshells. You know, you were afraid to really do anything that was going to upset him. So you were very hypervigilant in terms of what you did or what you didn't do. And I would think that would almost have lent you to adopt a perfectionistic stand in terms of being afraid to make a mistake and trying to do everything perfectly, which again, perfectionism is something that is striving for that is the key to a lot of misery for individuals, particularly as they get older. The other thing that struck me is adverse childhood experiences, and that early experience matters. And if that narrative is not taken care of early on, that translates into adulthood and for generations and generations after. Even if the behavior doesn't occur, the rules that contributed to the behavior still go on and can contribute to more generational dysfunction down the road. So it sounds like you were adopted into a very, let's say, at least unhealthy family system.
Yeah, that's a very fair statement. My mom could not have children, and so that's why they adopted. I don't sit here saying that every single day was horrible. As I mentioned, there were some good points, but when you're around someone like that, You are in fear of doing one mistake, not living up to meeting the bar, or you forget to lock the car door at night.
Yeah.
It's just the simplest things, but that was just the environment that I grew up in. And so as a young adult, I couldn't wait to get away from it, because that to me meant freedom. Because I had never felt free, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Was your dad abusive in any other ways other than verbal abuse? Was it physical? Was it any other type of abuse that you can recall growing up, Scott?
Yeah, there was some, not a heavy amount, but there was some physical abuse as well. I remember getting smacked around a handful of times. I think the bigger way he was abusive was my dad was I've used this expression. He had a military grade level of manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
He was a master manipulator. I mean, master. And he could do it in a way that you wouldn't even see it coming. And so he manipulated not only myself, he manipulated family members, he manipulated other people to have them do what he wanted them to do. And again, as I said earlier, if that's all you know, and you've never been around really anything else, that's normal. Even though maybe in your heart, you have a sense of, man, this is, something's not right, but you don't have anything to compare it to. And so, yeah, he was a master manipulator. He used guilt often. In fact, later on, as I'll share more with my story, guilt was a huge piece of who he became. And he guilted me on many occasions. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's one of the many manipulative tools that abusers use to keep control of their victims, whether it's a domestic violence situation, the kids. Did you ever witness any abuse from your father to your mother? Did you ever see any of that?
Yeah, I did. In fact, there's still one specific time. There were multiple times, but there was one specific time that still never been able to quite fully get that scene out of my head. But yeah, I remember him smacking her, hitting her pretty heavy one night in a fit of rage. And that was early on. That was when I was much younger. So yeah, there was definitely that, but there was far more, Dave, there was far more verbal, emotional manipulation, that kind of abuse, than there was physical, by far.
Yeah. It's not only were you the victim of it, if your mother was the victim of it and you witnessed it, you might as well be getting abused again, just watching that vicariously.
Yes. Yes. Correct. And when you're, when you're in fear, you combine that with a really low self-esteem, meaning not thinking that you matter much. It was a double whammy in that I couldn't, even as a young man, as a teenager, I didn't feel like I could step in and protect her from that, So yeah, you're right. What you just said is very accurate.
So let's talk about August of 1991. This is where your life changed forever. How old were you then? And can you share some of what happened and what your life looked like after that?
Yeah, you betcha. Yeah, so August 5th, 1991, that was a Monday night. And I was living, I was out of the house on my own at that time. And on that particular day, I had scheduled a dinner, a family dinner with my mom and dad at their house after my normal work day. And so I stopped in, and you got to remember, this is 91, right? This is before the era of cell phones, and shoot, we still had long distance phone calls were expensive. So, oh gosh, I feel like I just dated myself, Dave. But
if I may add to that, text messages were like sending notes to each other in the classroom. So
exactly, right, exactly. But yeah, so I went over there after work, had dinner. My mom made homemade spaghetti, which was one of her that was always an incredible meal. And I was there a couple hours and we had dinner. It was actually an enjoyable dinner. My dad was not on his soapbox. He wasn't yelling. He wasn't screaming. He was just like normal, which was nice, which was really nice. And the end of that meal, I made a couple phone calls. I did a couple things and I was getting ready to walk out the door and was saying my goodbyes. And my mom followed me kind of in their little hallway that goes to the front door. And I opened up the door and was taking a step out. And she says, "Hey, you," she says, "come here and give me a hug and a kiss," you know, like any mom would do. And I turned around, gave her a hug, gave her a kiss on the cheek. And what I didn't know was that was going to be the last time I'd ever see her again. And about 4 to 5 hours later, I was in my bed asleep and I got a phone call. And it was my cousin. And he was a little bit in a state of like, not panic, but very clearly something wasn't right. He said, "You need to get over here, mom and dad's house, like right now, right now. Whatever you're doing, you need to get over here." And I remember realizing that something very, very serious had happened. And I could tell in my heart, I could just tell in my gut. And on the drive over there, I got this really, really sick feeling. I didn't know what it was, but I just got a really sick feeling. And when I turned that last turn to go down the straightaway that they lived on, the house that I grew up in, when I turned on that street, you know, it was close to midnight by this point, and it looked like a small city, Dave, down by where my parents' house was. There was lights and flashing lights. And in short, to kind of speed the story along, I pull up and I'm going to make a beeline into my parents' house. There's ambulances, multiple ambulances, paramedics, county, state, and city police. And they have the whole area roped off with that yellow caution tape that says, "Do not cross," right? Crime scene, do not cross. And my heart is just, boop, 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 boop. I mean, I'm the adrenaline's pumping and I'm going to make a beeline. I'm going to go inside the house. And I got sidelined by a police officer and which he wouldn't let me go in. And he pulled me off to the side and he started questioning me. And at this point, I still didn't know what had happened. And within a few minutes, he finally said, "Son, I'm sorry, your mom is deceased. And we have your father in custody." And that is in the moment, Dave, it's very difficult to describe what a person's feeling, but you kind of go numb. And I think that's maybe it's a protective mechanism we have to not feel certain things at the intensity or send us into a heart attack or something, you know. And in short, what had happened, I had found out that my father, in a fit of rage that night, he went into the garage and he had found a steel bar that was somewhere between 2 and 3 feet long. And while my mom lay sleeping in her bed, he went in a very barbaric way. He took her life. And as you might imagine, and anybody listening, you know, my life and my family's life, we were it was forever changed. When I think back on that, it was so, I'm searching for words. I'm sorry. Gosh, I've shared this story 100 times and, sometimes it's difficult to find the words. My apologies, but you just kind of go into a numb feeling. And not really certain what you feel, what you think. And you want to think that this is just a really horrible dream, right? This is a horrible nightmare and you're going to wake up from it. But unfortunately, it's not. I mean, it was a reality. And so my dad went off to jail and we had mom's service. At that point, they had been married 20. Oh gosh, I could have this number wrong. They'd been married at that point, maybe 28 ish 29 years. And if they got a divorce, he knew he would walk away with nothing. What happened after all this was I have a half sister, and she would be half sister by adoption, and which is my dad was her biological father, if that makes sense. And her and I had not really been close, but we had a relationship. And she said, I have to go see him. I have to look into his eyes. And I have to hear him say that he did this. And she said, do you want to go with me? Now, this was about 2 weeks after, 2.5 weeks after the incident. And I said, okay. I said, I'll go. And again, Dave, like I said, I'm numb. I'm just numb at this point, you know, in disbelief of what has happened. And we go over to the county jail where he's being held. And it's just like what you would see in the movies, you know, it's the glass and it's the phone, and you're sitting there and he's in the orange jumpsuit, you know, and in handcuffs and that sort of thing. And I'm looking at him, and remember what I said, my father was extremely manipulative, and just by him looking at me in my eyes, I could tell he was up to something. And we're talking on the phone, and he says, do you think I killed your mom? And I said, I don't know what to believe. I can't process this. I think this feels more like a horrible nightmare. So I don't know what to think. And he looked right at me, Dave, and he says, well, I didn't, but I told the police I did to cover up for you because I thought you did it.
Wow.
So if, you know, you drop a bomb after another bomb, you can imagine what that was like. And I remember just not feeling anything, not saying anything. I think I just gazed off and our conversation stopped. I don't think I was able to say anything. I just was so, now you got to remember, this is a man who manipulated me my whole life. This was not the first time by any means. And from there, I just kind of withdrew. My sister, half sister, she went in and talked to him afterwards. And on the way home, I couldn't say anything. And she asked me, what did he say to you? And I told her. And she was just like, she couldn't say anything. I think the only thing she said was, oh my God. You know, I think that was all she really said. So that was the event that forever sent me on a very different path in life from where I was at. Because at the time, 22 years old, trying to figure life out, no real strong foundation. Really no self-belief in myself, low self-esteem. I've been manipulated all my life. I don't know what a healthy relationship is. I'm attracted to all the wrong kinds of girls because of things that were, you know, done in my... And that was kind of the road that there was that fork in the road. And I went off, I kind of went off the deep end. And yeah.
Well, you know, it's a predictable progression, Scott, given what you were raised with. I mean, what most individuals would consider to be, for lack of a better term, normal dynamics, normal relationship. You grew up in anything but. You grew up in chaos. You grew up in unpredictability. You grew up where relationships were about power, control, manipulation. So, I mean, you could not have had healthy relationships modeled in that circumstance. So without any further understanding or further intervention, you know, John Bradshaw, who did a lot of work with codependency, says hockey players don't play with chess players. They play with the same individuals who know the same rules. So you aligned with individuals who were very similar with rules that grew out of chaos, that grew out of unhealthy dynamics, and it's just predictable that you went that way. And it's neither judgmental. It's not judgmental. It's just the way it is. It's the way it happened.
Yeah, right.
Just backtracking a little bit, I know you mentioned there was a celebration of life. Do you recall any memories, positive memories you have from that celebration, things that kind of stood out, that kind of balanced the numbness and the pain that you were going through? Any positive moments you remember from that?
I remember we, I say the family when I say we, but I think it was geared a little more towards myself and probably my father, because at that time, they had let him out for a few days. This was before he confessed. So the amount of outpouring of love and sympathy and compassion that I got from people who knew myself and the family and the community was overwhelming. I remember reading through those cards just one after another, and just remember they meant so much. They just hit my heart. I remember that as a very positive experience. A little bit on a more lighthearted note, at mom's celebration of his life, it was also the first time that I ever did a public speech. And I flubbered through it. And certainly, was so raw, and it was so emotional and different things like that. I don't even remember much of what I said, but I think those are the two things that probably stand out the most, in directly answering your question.
Well, thank you for that, Scott. And the other thing, I have my own story of tragedy. I know we talked about that during the pre-chat with my daughter's transition to a new existence. And there are days that it's been over 22 years. There are days I can tell the story, and it's just part of who I am. And there's other days I get choked up. It's just the way it is with grief, the way it is with life-altering changes, is that sometimes the raw emotion of it's going to hit you when you're least expecting it. But what's also going on in the present moment? And I'm thinking it was August of 91 where your life changed forever. We're recording this in August. So when I was listening to you, as you mentioned, apologizing for stumbling a little bit, I'm thinking in my head, well, it's August. It was August 91. It's August 2025. And you take a look at it was August 5th when your mom was murdered, correct?
Yeah,
And
correct.
we're, if it's August 8th that we're recording. So you're talking 3 days after that. So you're just 3 days past the 24-year mark, date of her death. So sometimes those emotions just hit us when we're least expecting it. But
Right.
it's also, as I've learned, it's also kind of another part of the grief journey that I think informs us that we still love our loved ones as much as we do, and that
Sure.
love doesn't die because a person's not physically here, so.
Right. I appreciate that. Can I be transparent with you for a little bit off of topic for just a moment?
Sure, you sure can.
I'm going to say this for me. I'm not going to say it for other people. I want to be respectful of their journey and how they feel and how they view things. One indicator for me that helps me, or reminds me, maybe that's the right word, Dave. It helps to remind me that I've healed, is that until we started talking right here, and you mentioned that August 5th, that day came and went, and I didn't think about the event. And I think that is a reminder to me that says, I can think about my mom whenever I want. It's not just on August 5th. And it doesn't have to be in a remorseful, sad way. And so now there's been other years, prior years, that I've not thought about her when that tragical day came and went. But it just at this moment with you, this was a reminder to go, you know what? Yes, of course you're still sad about it sometimes, and you miss her and wonder what life would be without her. But I think I've healed so much from that those days don't trigger me. I don't wake up in a state of tears. I've healed. I've felt the emotions. I've processed that trauma. So anyway, just a little side note, not to get off the track too much here.
No, I think it's right on point. because this is all an outgrowth of your story. And these are things that happen when we tell our story. Those emotions will come up when we least expect it. And you're right. It's permission for us so we can remember our loved ones outside of significant dates of their life and death, that we can remember them at any time. And that's why relationships, in my mind, don't die.
Yeah.
They're always forever. Amazingly, you fully forgave your father. Many I know would have difficulty, myself included, with considering forgiveness in those same circumstances. What was a turning point for you that allowed you to embrace forgiveness with your dad? And why was this important for you in the healing process?
Yeah, I'm going to answer that. And then I'm going to share a little bit more about how I came to that.
Okay.
So the answer to your question is, I reached a point where I didn't want to carry the anger, the hurt, the resentment, the bitterness. I did not want to carry that in with the rest of my life. That's the answer. Let's go a little bit deeper on that. I went, after all those things happened, I kind of went into a tailspin and started drinking pretty heavily. I never really got into any hard drugs, but drinking seemed to take the edge off to where I could function without just losing my shit, to be honest. And so that kind of became part of my life. Now, it wasn't a drunken every single day fall down, but it was enough to where it would numb the pain. Mm-hmm. And I could function. And it was at work one day. This was about 3.5-4 years later. I was at work. And I sat down at a table. They had a cafeteria at that place of employment. And I was sitting down at a table by myself and I was eating. And it was a hard day. It was a rough day. I was struggling. And a coworker came and sat next to me. And he tried small talking and I wasn't in the mood. But he said, "How's it going? How are you doing?" And I said, "I'm all right." And he just looked at me. He goes, "Really? Are you okay?" And I just looked at him and, oh my gosh, I remember the moment so clear. I just lost it. I mean, I just lost it. And he said, "Doesn't look like you're okay." And I said, "No, I'm not." And he said something to me that was so simple, but it was so profound. He said, and I quote, "You know you can't keep living like this, right? You're headed down a dark road." And I knew he was right. I knew that he was right. And I knew that I couldn't keep living like that. And so I started going to some counseling. Now, I think there's, you know, counseling therapy, it's gotten some bad rap over the years. And I understand why. I'm very well aware of that. Here's what I will tell you about my experience. I found the right person. Not everybody does. I get that. I found the right person. Now call that a divine appointment. Call that luck, whatever you will. I found the right person and this person was able to help me. And it made, David, made all the difference in my life. I counseled with her about every 2 weeks for 2.5 years. So that's a significant amount of investment. And in that time also, I started having an attraction. I got into self-development, personal growth, becoming a better you, you know, feeling and dealing and healing with all of your trauma. I mean, those sorts of things. Wayne Dyer, I just dove into his stuff. It just spoke to me so clearly. And I started to undo the example that I use, Dave, is I started to undo everything that my father had done. I started to unpack it. And that takes time and that takes work. And I think a lot of people, they feel like it doesn't feel good because you have to face some demons. You have to face some ugly stuff. You have to admit some things. You have to talk about emotions and feelings that are not always comfortable. But I was willing to do the work. And why was I willing to do the work? The answer that I gave you just a moment ago. I did not want to carry this crap with me the rest of my life because I knew it would destroy me. I just knew it. I knew it would destroy me. And so to go on and talk a little more about the forgiveness, it was towards the end of my counseling. And I remember her name's Janet. We're still Facebook friends today, actually, interestingly enough. But she starts talking to me about forgiveness. And I go, oh, I already know what forgiveness is. And she just kind of laughed, you know, and we continue on with our talking. And I started to realize, wait a minute, hold on. I don't know what authentic forgiveness is. Thought I did. And she started helping me to see what that really meant, what that meant to me. She started helping me to see who is forgiveness for, right? I mean, there's this huge lie in our American culture that we want to think, well, the reason I won't forgive someone is because they don't deserve it. Or, well, I could never forgive them. Okay, wait a minute. Forgiveness isn't for them. Forgiveness is for us. It's not for them. See, when you start to get an accurate belief about what forgiveness is and who it's for, now we take that element and we turn it back on us and go, wait a minute, how does this benefit me? Not for the benefit of the other person.
Yep.
And she helped me to kind of unpack all of that and start to see that. And I realized, holy cow, if I'm going to truly let go of this, I've got to forgive him. And was that easy? Come on. Hell no, it wasn't easy. You didn't expect me to say it was easy, did you? You know, it was tough. And it took me probably, honest to goodness, it probably took me 12 years before I could look in the mirror or I could look at a picture of him, of my father, and look at it and be able to say, I forgive you. I don't wish any ill will. I'm not angry with you. I'm not mad at you. And genuinely mean it. It probably took 12 years, maybe 13. But I did reach a point where I was able to do that. And in that, Dave, I uncovered 6 different areas where I think we often get tripped up. We get stuck. And at least for me, I identified 6 different areas. And once I was able to fully understand each one of those areas and have an accurate understanding about it, I was able to forgive the man who killed my mom and completely let go of it.
That's an amazing story. That's an amazing turning point that you came through in yourself. And, you know, forgiveness isn't about exonerating the other person for his actions. It's just basically, it's, you know, finding peace with your life as it is and being able to forgive somebody who, as you mentioned, and I'm paraphrasing this, was going to run a lot of space in your head if you didn't, you know. Yeah. So the 6 areas that you mentioned or the 6 different obstacles or areas that you mentioned, I'm sure that's a part of what you talk about when you speak and when you do other types of work with individuals who are struggling with life trauma. Can you give us an overview of what those 6 areas are that we need to be mindful of addressing if we're going to be able to achieve forgiveness towards somebody or something?
Yeah, you bet. I'll touch on them and then just give a small little description, if you're okay with that, of what that means.
Yep.
The first one, and these aren't necessarily in a specific order. It's not like this is the most important and this is the least. This doesn't have that. This doesn't have a prioritization. But the first one, I think, is look, you have to want to. You have to want to. What do I mean by that? If you are actively plotting revenge against someone, that's not wanting to forgive them. That's wanting to get even. I understand that. You cannot actively forgive someone if you're wishing them death wishing them ill will, wishing them that they, well, they'll get theirs. Karma's going to come back around and they're going to have a horrible life. They're going to get cancer, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. You have to want to. And I wanted to, because again, it comes back to what I answered your question with. I didn't want to carry this ugliness, this weight. I didn't want to carry it around with me. So that's the first one you have to want to. The second one that I already mentioned is we have to understand something, that forgiveness is not for the other person. Forgiveness is for us.
Yep.
It's just literally that simple. And that is, there's a huge myth, a cultural belief, I guess, if you will, that people often think that forgiveness is for the other person, and it's not. It is letting yourself free, allowing yourself to let go of all of that anger, the hurt, the bitterness, whatever it is. So forgiveness is for us. That's another thing that you have to believe. You have to understand that. That leads me into, people often also think, well, if I forgive somebody, I'm letting them off the hook. It's not true.
No.
Those two things are separate. By forgiving somebody, you're not excusing what they did. You're not. And again, cultural realms say that we put those in the same box.
Mm-hmm.
No, you're not letting them off the hook. And I do a deep dive on some of this stuff, because that leads into the realm of when you can forgive somebody, you set boundaries.
Yep.
So that they don't hurt you again, which leads me into my next one. Forgiveness is not the same as trust. Trust and forgiveness, I mean, look them up. If you don't believe me, look them up in the dictionary. Two very different definitions. Trust does not equal forgiveness. Forgiveness doesn't equal trust. You can forgive somebody and not trust them.
Yep.
And I can make a list of people that I have forgiven, but I don't trust them again.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll just one step further with the example of my father. He was a pretty bad dude. Could you imagine that if I forgave him and automatically gave him trust into my life again? Can you imagine how ugly that would be?
Yeah, it sure as heck wouldn't be pretty.
No. So I forgave him and he was not allowed. He was not allowed back into my life. And if we have time, we can talk more about that. The other one is forgiving doesn't equate to forgetting.
Yeah.
You are not required to forget in order to forgive. Now, I don't even remember the first time I heard it, Dave, but it said, well, you haven't really forgiven someone if you haven't forgotten about it, right? You've heard that.
Mm-hmm.
What a load of crap.
Mm-hmm.
Where did that come from? Who made that up? No, BS. You think a situation like this, do you think the woman who's been raped, do you think the person who had their spouse killed in a car accident, you think they're just going to forget about something like that? No, you're never required to forget about it. Forgiveness and forgetting are two separate things. The idea here is that we forgive so that when we remember, it doesn't cripple us.
Yep.
It doesn't paralyze us. We don't go and want to hide in the corner or hide under the covers. We can remember it and still function. That's the forgiveness correlation to the forgetting piece, okay? And then we move into the last one, which gets pretty deep, and I'm going to just touch the surface of it. I believe forgiveness is not necessarily just a one-time thing. What do I mean by that? I'm going to give you the answer, then I'm going to share with you what I mean by that. I probably had to forgive my father. My best guess is somewhere between 150 to 200 times to fully let go of that. Now that's, again, over the course of 12, 13 years. Mm-hmm. What do I mean by that? This is not a Sunday sermon by any means, but I'm going to use the quick example. In Matthew 18, Peter goes to Jesus and says, and most people have heard this parallel, this part of scripture, but Peter goes to Jesus and goes, How many times do you think I should forgive him? Do you think I should forgive him seven times? Right? And Peter probably thought, seven times? That's pretty noble. That's pretty righteous. Here, I can forgive him seven times. And Jesus says,
no. How about seven times 70
or seven times 77 or 77 times? Depending upon which translation in scripture you read, you're going to get a little different answer. But we can all agree on it was a significant amount more than just seven times, right? And what did he mean by that? Now, this is my conviction. I'm not any of your listeners. I'm not asking you to believe my philosophy. I am sharing with you what my conviction is. It's not a belief. It's a conviction. I will stand on this until the day I die. And that is this. I believe every time that when those thoughts and those feelings came up again of my father being angry at him for killing my mom, I had to stop and go, nope, nope, I forgive you. I'm not going to harbor that anger. I forgive you. And I would say that out loud every time. Now, I created a habit. So was that easy? Was that organic in the beginning? No, no. But here's what I realized. When all my buddies took their dad one Friday night and we went up in the mountains and built a big bonfire and hung out with our dads and I was the only one there without a father, I had to forgive that. I had to forgive my dad again. And when I married my wife, the neighbor girl, and my mom and dad weren't there, I had to forgive him again. And when my firstborn daughter, Dave, I'm going to get emotional. My daughter, she is seconds old. Seconds. My wife gives delivery. The nurse doesn't take the baby away. She says, here you go, Dad. And she puts her in my arms. I'm holding this little girl who's seconds old into this life. And in a puddle of tears, I remember thinking, I could be mad at my dad right now because my mom's not here to experience this. And I had to, out loud, I had to say again, I forgive you. I'm not carrying that anger. And I did it again when my second daughter was born. And I did it again and again and again and again. I had to forgive him. And I believe that's what in scriptures, that's what Jesus was talking about when we have to forgive somebody over and over again. And after doing that for a lengthy period of time, that was one of the key elements for me of how do you forgive murder? Mm-hmm. That's how you do that. Yep. You have to want to do it. You say it out loud. And it, was it easy in the beginning? Was it organic? Did it feel right? No, none of those things. None of those things. But I chose that I didn't want to carry this with me. And so that's what I did. Those were the six things that I did.
Yeah, that's an impressive model that you've come up with and an impressive way to lay that out. What that proves to me is like with anything, grief isn't a linear process. Forgiveness certainly isn't a linear process. As I was sitting there, I was trying to put myself in your shoes, and I'm thinking, not only would I have had to forgive my father every time, you know, when your firstborn, your daughter was born, when you got married, and your mother wasn't there, your second daughter was born, I would also have to forgive him for every time an event came up that reminded me of the abuse that he did to me, that he did to my mother. I also have to forgive him for that as well, too. And like with everything, build. You know, our need to forgive is going to surface as many times as it's going to until it doesn't need to anymore, until we can just kind of say, okay, I've let that pass. I've dealt with that. I'm at peace with it. And you won't forget it because, one, you can't forget it. And secondly, there's always going to be reminders that aren't going to allow you to forget. Yeah. So it's like, how do I choose to manage this?
Right.
And I think that's the biggest key. It isn't just what we forgive and our life goes on as, you know, we pick up where we should have left off. We just forgive and our life goes on the way it was meant to go on after the life-altering tragedy changed it. So it just allows us to do that, I think, with more grace and less baggage.
Agreed. Agreed. It's a process.
Yeah.
It's a process. You know, our culture, we want to hit the easy button, don't we?
Oh, yeah. It's quick fix for everything, Scott. Pillow fix this.
Yeah.
Yeah, you want to lose 30 pounds, do this fat burning medication. It's just quick fix. And so that we can go on to lead happy, fulfilled existences. It's not reality.
Yeah, no, it's not. And, you know, again, this was a 12 to 13 year journey. It didn't happen overnight. Was it worth it? Oh my gosh. Hands down, tenfold, yes. Mm. You know, I was able to break a generational cycle.
Yeah.
And truth be known, my dad's dad and his dad and his dad, I learned this later on from other family members, that he was being the kind of father that he had been exposed to.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was only doing what he knew to do, what he knew to do, the example he was given. And so at some point, you know, for the folks that are listening, who's going to be the one that stops the cycle?
Yeah.
Who's going to be the one that shows up and sets a new standard and says, this isn't acceptable. I want better for my kids. I want better for my grandkids, mm-hmm. you know, and there is nothing special about me. I'm a small town kid that has just overcome a lot of crap. I didn't have any foundations of faith of God. I found those later in life because of hardship. But at some point, someone has to come forward and said, I'll be that guy. I'll be that gal. I'll be that gal. I'll be that mom. I'll be that aunt that changes direction. And is it worth it? Oh, 100%. Oh, my gosh. So worth it.
And that's why there's no quick fix to transformation. Transformation involves work. It's never circular. Yeah. There's always stops and starts. There's always self-doubt. But in the end, if we put in the work and we move towards something that we know is going to lead to a better and more fulfilled life for us, the work is worth it. And the transformation is much, much more permanent.
Yeah.
And the results are permanent.
Agreed. 100%. You bet.
Scott, we're just about coming to our time. Boy, I could talk to you for another hour. We could go on and on and on and on and on with this, particularly about how forgiveness can help us set boundaries. I think that would be something for another episode down the road with you and me. I think we could just do a whole
episode love that.
Around that. Me too.
Yeah, I'd love that, Dave. And I do believe it is essential to empowering and embracing and keeping the forgiving aspect.
Yep.
There has to be boundaries in place.
Absolutely. So maybe that's something down the road we can entertain.
I love that. Can I share just a parting statement?
I was going to ask you to give our audience one takeaway, a parting statement, something you want to leave them with today.
Yeah. There's a lot of hurting people in the world, and they're carrying that around with them like a backpack. They have this backpack on. And there's all of these hurts. There's all of this trauma. There's all of these feelings, and you're carrying it with you every day. And I get it. I was there. I get it. I really do. And at some point, you need to say, I'm not going to carry this anymore. And is it going to be a little uncomfortable to make that happen? Yeah, it will be a little uncomfortable. A lot?
No,
I don't think so. But it's going to take some effort. It's going to take some intention. And when someone says, okay, Scott, how do I start the forgiveness process? What's really the first thing? I think you've got to get clear on what is it that you, or who is it, right? What is it? Who is it that you're going to forgive? You got to get clear on that. Mm-hmm. And that just takes a little bit of self-work. Write some things down, write some feelings down. And when you've identified that person or that event, I would start by what that last principle that I told you about ongoing forgiveness. I think that's where you start, is you say, okay, I am going to forgive him. I'm going to forgive her. I'm going to forgive them. And it will not feel organic when you say it. It's going to contradict everything in here. Mm. I get it. But that doesn't mean you should stop. Because at some point, you're going to mean it. And it's going to be exactly who you are on the inside. But you have to continue to verbalize that. And there's going to be days where you're hurting, you're mad, you're pissed, you're angry. You feel like the victim. I get it. And you still have to make the choice to say, no, I may feel like this, but damn it, I choose to forgive them. You still have that power to do that.
Absolutely.
Even when you feel like it's the last thing in the world you want to say, you still have the authority and the power to do that. And not only do you have the authority, I would encourage you to do it, because that's when you're going to get the most traction.
Yeah.
I forgive him. I forgive him. I forgive him. That's where you start. That's where you start.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things I think even individuals who are in the midst of trauma or in the aftermath of trauma forget is that they still have self-determination. They still have self-will. They can choose to do whatever it is they need to do. They can choose to forgive. They can choose not to forgive.
Mm-hmm.
We may not agree with the choice of them not trying to embrace forgiveness, but who am I to say they need to? Maybe they just can't at that particular point or don't want to. I need to respect that choice, even if I don't believe it's the right course for them to take. It's the only ethical way to go with that, is respecting people's right to self-determine and let them figure out for themselves what the consequences of that choice are going to be. My last question, Scott, a little chance to self-promote here for a bit. People want to get in touch with you, find out about your services that you provide, find out about your speaking schedule, what you offer to organizations. What's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, a couple different ways. You can find me on LinkedIn. I try to stay active on LinkedIn, although I'm not that guy that's posting content every day. Just not. My schedule's too busy and it's not a priority. But you can find me on LinkedIn. You can also find me on Facebook. I have a professional page and a personal page now. Please understand, if you send me a friend request and I've never heard of you, I'm probably not going to accept it. Don't take it personal. But find my professional page. That's Scott Stewart, author, speaker, overcomer, or overcomer, speaker, something like that. Mm-hmm. But that's my professional page. Please feel free to follow along. I post a lot of encouraging stuff on there, thought-provoking ideas, little hints around forgiveness. Those kinds of things. You can find me there. And then as well as my website, that's scottstewartspeaking.com. scottstewartspeaking.com. And hey, if something I said in this podcast interview, if something like hit you, like, and you're just like, oh my gosh, that was very meaningful, I'd love to hear that. You can shoot me an email, scottstewartspeaking@gmail.com. scottstewartspeaking@gmail.com. And I'd love to, just drop me a line. And as I have time, I'll get back to you and stuff. But I'd like to know, did I say something today that really helped? Or at least got you thinking or moving in the right step, you know? So.
It sounds good. And I'll also, Scott, make sure that all your contact information gets into the episode notes as well, too. So, Scott, thank you so much for a very powerful, a very enlightening, and a very impactful conversation, which I enjoyed greatly. And I definitely want to do this again with you if you're up again for another podcast with me. So,
oh, that'd be great, Dave. I love talking about boundaries. It's one of those things that just change and help people. People should do a lot more of it. It's very healthy. It's a very healthy thing. So I look forward to it, bud.
Sounds great. And with that is a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.